I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. A New Jersey woman was arrested a few years ago after leaving her sleeping toddler in her car while she shopped. The New Jersey Supreme Court has decided to hear her appeal to determine whether her actions were child abuse or bad judgment. There are other cases that have raised similar questions. A South Carolina woman was arrested for allowing her child to play in a park while she worked. A father in Ohio was charged with child endangerment when his son skipped church and ended up at a local store. So today on Radio Times, what these cases raise about parents and kids, bystanders, and the law. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Dorothy Roberts. She's a professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dorothy Roberts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's good to be here.
You know, this is an issue that just touches on so many other issues. I almost don't know where to begin. But what got us thinking about the show was this case in New Jersey. And then all of a sudden, all these stories we were reading in the last week about cases of the kind of criminalization of parents when it comes to maybe making bad decisions, but making bad decisions out in public. I'm curious about how you are looking or thinking about some of these cases.
Well, I've been working in the child welfare field for a long time, so I'm well aware that there are already hundreds of thousands of children in foster care who are there because their parents are alleged to have abused or neglected them. So it's not brand new that parents are punished in some way for failing to take proper care of their children. But it does seem like we're seeing more and more of this in the news. And it may be because they're more bystanders, just regular people who are turning in parents instead of the mandated reporters like teachers and doctors. And it may also be that we're seeing more middle-class parents who are getting sucked into this. And so it gets more attention. It may just be that it's now part of the news cycle. Or there may actually be an escalation of the criminalization, not just civil abuse and neglect, but arresting parents for failing to take care of their children.
I want to pick up on all of that, but I posted something on our Facebook page basically saying if you walked by a car and it was locked and you saw a child inside, what would you do? And the first comment was, I call 911. And I was thinking myself, if I saw that, what would I do? And there's a good chance I might call 911 because I'd be worried about the child inside.
Yeah, I think that is probably a common response. It depends on the situation. It may also be possible to call the parent. In the case of the woman in South Carolina whose daughter was playing in the park, I wondered why the bystander who was worried about the 9-year-old girl didn't have her call her mother on the cell phone. She had a cell phone. The daughter had a cell phone with her, or ask more about her, or try to find the mother, or inquire. And I think maybe people are more quick now to call the police than they used to be in the past. You know, you see a child having a tantrum, and you call the police, or you see a child in a store and call the police. I think that might be a new development because of the hysteria. I'm not saying that there aren't good reasons why sometimes you should be extra concerned about children, but I think there's also a whipped-up frenzy about certain risks to children that, in my opinion, aren't as great as the harm that comes from arresting their parents and the known trauma to children when their parents are arrested and the children are placed in foster care. We have to take that into account as well.
I did a very unscientific sample of people I know. These are middle-class parents, asking them, you know, did you ever run and do an errand and leave your child, a young child, maybe not a baby, but a young child alone in the car? And I would say most people did. They said, look, I knew I would be in there for 15 seconds.
Right.
And all of that. And I would say I probably did that myself. So
right.
It is one of those decisions that a parent makes for their own reasons. Sometimes it's a neglectful one. Sometimes it's a bad one. But I think parents do it.
Parents have to do it. I think in every one of these cases, we can see a parent in a tension between taking the child with her, in many of these cases their mothers taking the child with her, or leaving the child in some other situation, and there are pros and cons to both of them. And to me, one important question here is, shouldn't we leave a lot of these decisions to the parents who know their child better and in most cases care for the child? I don't think there's any evidence in the cases you mentioned that the parents didn't love and care for their children. They made a decision that the prosecutors think was too risky. But all of this is so vague and so subjective, and we would find, I think, debate in every one of these situations about what the parent should do. So to me, in most cases, the parent is the best judge of how to care for the child, unless there's evidence that they were trying to harm the child or so grossly negligent, so outside of what most parents would do. That's not the case in any of these situations. As you just said, in the case of the New Jersey mother, I think many of us can remember situations where we left a child briefly in a car, and the evidence in that case was 5 to 10 minutes,
right,
to run an errand, to pick up something very quickly, where we judged that the risk was so small, it wasn't worth it to wake a sleeping child or disturb a child who might be sick. Now, I have to say, in the appellate case, the court did look at whether it was an emergency or not and found it wasn't an emergency. So those are important aspects as well. But in many of these cases, I think the mothers are in very difficult situations, especially where we're talking about poor or low-income mothers who don't have adequate child care, and they're trying to make do with what they have.
Well, picking up on that, the woman in South Carolina who was arrested for allowing her child to play in a park while she worked, yes, the child did have a cell phone, and apparently the child would come to work with her.
Right.
They had a laptop so that she could amuse herself or keep herself occupied during the day. I read they got robbed, they lost the laptop, and so the mother was, this was the decision that she made.
Right. She was struggling to figure out what was the best thing to do with her daughter during the summer when school is out, so you have the entire day, work day, to take care of a child. That is not easy. And she made the decision initially that the child would play on the laptop at her place of work, McDonald's.
Right.
And then, because the laptop was stolen, she had to figure out something else. And it seemed to her that the best alternative was to let her daughter play in the park. Not, you know, in a deserted lot somewhere, but in a park where there were other parents, other child givers, other children playing. And that decision, I think, is very contested. I think there are many people, including experts, who would say that was a good decision. It's good to let children play outdoors. We hover over our children too much. They spend too much time inside playing on a laptop. You know, it's funny. I'm concerned about my son spending too much time. I wish he would go outdoors more. He's always inside on his laptop. And so to me, that's a good decision, but it's a contested one. And that's the point. We shouldn't be arresting parents over contested decisions that based on very vague statutes.
Well, I'm also thinking, you know, on the other hand, and thinking of bystanders and sometimes being a bystander myself and seeing something, an interaction between a parent and a child that looks abusive to me or looks scary to
me.
And there is always that question about, I mean, forget the law, like, you know, human nature.
Or
do we, trying to sort of figure out what are those appropriate moments? There might be a reason why a child, a parent is shaking a child, and there might be a good reason for that. But nonetheless, to the outsider, it looks bad.
Yeah, that's a difficult judgment because as an outsider, you don't know the situation. You don't know the child. You don't know the parent. It always, I think, looks worse when a child is really upset and throwing a tantrum and the parent doesn't know quite what to do. It could look like abuse. But I think there's another aspect to this. There's the bystander aspect. But then let's say the bystander decides, look, I just have to call the police. I really think this is abuse. Then what's the next step? And in so many of these cases, it's arrest, it's placement of children in foster care. That response is excessive. It's punitive. We really have to think about the harms to children of unnecessarily placing them in state custody and the harms to primarily mothers, but parents in general, and their families of arresting them or even getting them involved in the child welfare system. There has to be alternatives of providing child care, counseling, a kind and loving response to parents who are struggling or maybe made a bad judgment. So it's the bystander, but it's also this excessive state response to parents who are trying their best to take care of their children.
Do you see the law? I'm your lawyer. Do you see the law as a kind of a blunt instrument then in dealing with these cases? Each of one has their own narrative.
I think it's interesting. It goes both ways. It's blunt in the sense that it can allow for arrests of parents where there is based on a very vague statute of defining what is parental neglect. And when you have vague statutes like that, it means you can have a blunt punishment, but the decision of what constitutes neglect is left to the discretion of the reporters, the prosecutors, the child welfare workers, judges. And we know that when you have that kind of discretion, especially in this area of parenting, it leaves room for racial biases and class biases and gender biases. And so in overall, even though we're hearing a lot about middle-class parents, overall, the child welfare system is primarily targeted at poor, low-income families of color. The vast majority of parents who get charged with neglect in the child welfare system are poor parents, and disproportionately parents of color, especially Black and Native American parents. So that's an important aspect of this that shouldn't be lost. We're hearing about isolated cases, but there is a pattern, a longstanding pattern of blaming poor parents of color, especially mothers of color, for risk to their children. You know, the way I see this overall is that, you know, you ask, why is this happening? I think it's blaming mothers for harms to children instead of getting at what is really harmful to children, which is poor nutrition, inadequate housing, you know, shoddy schools, over-policing in inner city neighborhoods that causes the arrests of children and youth. Things like that, poor health care, that's what we should be focusing on, not blaming mothers for these risks to their children.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Dorothy Roberts. She's a professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We want to know what you think. We'll be right back.
Broadway Philadelphia supports WHYY and presents its 2014-2015 subscription season. Curated for theater aficionados, the season lineup features the Philadelphia debuts of Disney's Newsies, Dirty Dancing the Musical, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, and Motown the Musical at the Academy of Music, closing with Kinky Boots at the Forest Theater. Season subscribers receive priority seating and ticket exchange privileges. Tickets and information at KimmelCenter.org/Broadway.
Successful parents often leave their children with some pretty big shoes to fill, but that doesn't mean they have to wear them.
If you end up going into a field your parent is really successful in, you've got to push away to find out who you are. Maybe I did it a little longer than was necessary.
That's the classic singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. Join us as she discusses her family legacy and her own brand of rock and roll this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After a lifetime of making romantic comedies like When Harry Met Sally or his latest And So It Goes, what has Rob Reiner learned about relationships?
What I've discovered is that women are just more evolved than men.
Rob Reiner on The Ways of the Heart, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a number of things, including the fact that the New Jersey Supreme Court has decided to hear an appeal from a woman who was charged with child abuse after leaving her child in the car while she shopped. We've been talking about this with our guest, Dorothy Roberts, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. Joining us now is Marie Myung Okeh-Lee, and she wrote an article in Salon titled, "The Day I Was Nearly Arrested for Having an Autistic Son," and she is teaches creative writing at Columbia University. And Marie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have Marie?
I am here.
Okay, Marie, that was a long and pregnant pause there. Very nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
Let me begin with your article, and you describe your son, who has autism, having a tantrum first on the street and then in a Whole Foods where you were shopping with your husband. Broadly speaking, what was the bystander or the crowd, the public's reaction to your son and how you and your husband were dealing with him?
I'll start by saying that our son has autism, but as opposed to him being high-functioning, he's fairly low-functioning. He's still in diapers, and he has limited verbal capacity, and he's also easily overstimulated, and I should also add he has digestive problems, so he can be in pain. So we were basically shopping in the Whole Foods, and we had just checked out, and he just had basically a tantrum. And sometimes when he has a tantrum, he acts out by aggressing against other people, and he bit me. And so my husband and I did what we would normally do, is we gently but firmly escorted him out of the store, one of us on each side, doing an approved hold that we had learned. Basically, we were holding his arms and escorting him out so he couldn't hurt anyone else or hurt himself. And he, when he gets in a tantrum mode, he likes to be back in an enclosed space, so we let him go back to our car. And he went back in the car and shut the door. It was a very cool day. It was about in the 70s. The window was cracked open. So we just stood there and waited until he finished his tantrum. And he did. And so we thought, okay, that's great. And we opened the hatch and turned back to get our groceries. And we saw a policeman coming towards us. And there was a row of people standing at the entrance of the Whole Foods. And a woman was screaming at us, saying, "They're treating their child like a dog, worse than a dog. Like, this is terrible." And she's trying to also get the people involved. Like, "Did you see that? Did you see them? I wouldn't treat a dog like that." And we just were we were completely baffled about what it is that she saw. And the policeman came, and we were very nervous about it, of course. And what was very lucky for us that day is we explained what had happened. Our son was very calm by then, and he was probably saying, hi, because he loves people in uniform. And he also said, "Oh, yeah, my nephew's autistic. I get it." And he just turned and walked away and didn't even take down our names or anything.
And this was the police officer saying, I have a nephew with autism. I understand, I guess, what it was that you as a family were going through?
Yes, that's exactly what he said. And then also, you know, my husband and I were middle-aged. We're stereotypical academics. We drive a Volvo. We're at Whole Foods. So there's also, I think, those kind of signifiers that, and also if we were kidnappers, we would be the world's worst kidnappers. We were standing there for 5 minutes waiting for our son, and we still, to this day, I actually wanted to go ask this woman what it is that she saw because I was so baffled. And by then, she was either embarrassed or something, but she jumped in her car and literally peeled out of the parking lot.
Dorothy, let me get you back in on the conversation. And we've been talking before Marie joined our conversation, focusing largely on poor women,
yes,
poor minority women.
Right.
And here we're hearing a professional couple having this bystander interaction.
Right. And as I said, I think part of what makes this a new news item is that bystanders are getting involved more and feel empowered to call the police when they see something they think is wrong. I think Marie's story also shows, though, how fortunate she was to be able to talk with a police officer as a professional woman and with her husband, and that the police officer understood. There are also thousands and thousands of cases of poor, mostly minority mothers who are struggling to take care of children with health problems, who end up in the foster care system because they don't have the resources, and because of a judgment that because they're poor and maybe don't have a high level of education, they are unable to make the proper decisions for their children. So instead of assisting these families, there is, I think, too quick a tendency to place the children in foster care in order to get the help that they need.
Marie, going back to you and thinking about perhaps other instances where you and your son have had some difficulties on the street, what do you want people to do? Do you want them to leave you alone? Do you want them to help you? I'm just trying to, as a bystander, trying to figure out what is the right thing to do when it's clear something is wrong.
I have a two-part answer to that, and neither of them are hard and fast. However, I have intervened myself before, and obviously I'm more autism literate than I would be if I didn't have a child with these issues. But generally, when I've seen what looks like a tantrum, I will often quietly ask the parent. In my case, it was a grandparent, you know, do you need help? You know, my son is like this. Is there something I can do? And actually, I've always been taken up on that offer. Which is different than, again, I think it would be difficult if I saw a kid in a hot car or, you know, but in this kind of situation, it's pretty clear to me, or even, I don't know, somebody struggling with trying to get their child down the stairs, I'm usually happy to say, you know, do you need help? They almost always say, are so grateful. But to the second part of that, I would like to take up what Professor Roberts was saying, is that a lot of times what are called bad decisions are actually not even decisions at all, because one of the things that we found is with our son's level of disability, we are eligible for certain services like respite care and so forth, but just the trying to apply for it and all of the bureaucracy and, you know, with my education and so forth, and then with the fact that my husband is also an academic and he can stay home with our child while I go to the Medicaid office. At one point, the woman just said, wow, I'm really happy for you, because most people just give up by then. Uh-huh. And so, do you see, it's not even like, it's more of a structural thing. It's even less of a parenting thing, that if you have a child who has these severe medical or behavioral needs, if you're not getting any kind of help either, you're just stuck, because you still have to go out for food with this child. And it's just, it's kind of a catch-22.
You're nodding your head vigorously, Dorothy Roberts.
Yes, and in fact, I think I used those exact words, catch-22, and Marty and I were talking earlier. Poor parents and low-income parents, single mothers, are stuck in a very difficult situation where there aren't enough resources for them to take care of their children, especially when they have children who have these medical problems or just everyday issues that come up with children, the needs of children. We're talking about food, shelter, childcare, basic needs that aren't available. I think it's interesting, Marie, that here you are a professional couple, and it's difficult for you to maneuver.
Mm-hmm. We have one child.
Exactly. Imagine how difficult it is for a low-income mom who is working full-time or maybe odd hours, may have more than one child, trying to navigate all of this. To me, it's about blaming these mothers for the risks that their children are facing instead of getting to the structural issues that you were talking about. Same thing with bystanders who, instead of going up, as you're suggesting, Marie, I think it's a beautiful statement, helping.
Can I help you?
Calling the police. All of this is a move to blame, to over-police, rather than to help. And our criminal law and child welfare systems need to be focused on helping to support parents, not being so quick to blame and arrest them.
And that's Dorothy Roberts. She's a professor of law, sociology, and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. On the telephone, Marie Myung Okeh-Lee, she teaches creative writing at Columbia University and wrote a piece recently in Salon titled "The Day I Was Nearly Arrested for Having an Autistic Son." Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Do we have Keith? Let me get Keith from Delaware.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I'm an African-American father, and I had a similar experience where I was almost arrested while parenting my autistic son, similar to the previous caller. He was upset because he wanted to get Chinese food, and we were not able to get it. And I stopped to get some juice at a juice bar, and he was upset, so he was having a tantrum. Now, when he has a tantrum, he decides to sit somewhere and don't move. So he sat down on the sidewalk and refused to move. So after about 20 minutes of trying to coax him to move, I had no choice other than to pick him up. And, of course, he was resisting, so I had to literally carry my resisting son. Now, my daughter is typically developing, and she was 10, and she was there. And there were some people around, younger than me. I'm 50 years old. And I explained to them, my son has special needs. Okay, you don't understand. And I had to carry my son down the street after I got about maybe 75 feet. He sat down again, and we go back and forth. I try to walk to see if he comes. But in any regard, within minutes, I was surrounded by about 10 police cars. And the irony was, some of them were riding around me repeatedly because I was going back and forth between carrying my son and letting him sit, so they didn't even know who I was. Ultimately, they determined that I was the person that, you know, someone called about. And, you know, I explained to them that my son is on medication, he has counselor, he's in therapy, and that he was simply having a tantrum. And luckily, they were very understanding, and I appreciated that. But here's what I think. I would like to add to what
you've done. Sure, go ahead, Keith.
When we're taking our children out like this, this is how we socialize them. Part of how we teach them is we have to bring them into the world with everyone else. So part of that world is no different if he was in a wheelchair. He would have to be accommodated. So his condition is being accommodated in the social world. So I take him out so that he can experience the world. This is how he learns. Now, when I have to be subjected to the possibility of being arrested because bystanders are calling the police, what that does, it has a chilling effect. It makes me reluctant to bring my son into the world.
Well, Keith, I
experience things.
Yeah, no, I first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you raise a number of points. Marie, let me just give you a chance to respond, and Dorothy, then go ahead. Marie?
Well, thanks, Keith, for saying that, because I think one of the most hurtful comments that I get when I write about my son is people say, well, why do you take him out? What's wrong with you? A child like that should stay home. And it just is also sort of negating the fact that my son is a human being and has the same rights as anyone else for being out in the world. And so I always get kind of flabbergasted. And again, you are in a kind of catch-22 where if you stay home, your child never learns how to be socialized, but when you're out, people want to call the police on you. So I'm sorry, I have no advice for you, but I can just say I deeply empathize.
Keith, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dorothy, I'm struggling because there was a time, or probably there still is a time, where people do not get involved. You know, there are plenty of examples of people that just stood by and let something terrible happen. And now we're talking about bystanders, in a sense, overreacting to certain incidents. And I'm struggling with this.
Yeah, I don't think it's a question of being involved or not involved. I think it's a question of how you're involved. I say the same thing about state involvement. I'm not arguing that this government shouldn't be involved in the care of children. It should be involved in a helpful way, though, not in a punitive way that in the end harms children more than anything else. As the caller was pointing out, this punitive attitude ends up deterring, chilling parents from bringing their children out, whether it's children with autism or other disabilities, bringing them into public, or children who don't have those disabilities but are playing in the park. I think that it could be that that mother in New Jersey, I don't know for sure, but right. maybe she didn't want to bring her sleeping child into the store because she was afraid the child would start crying, and then somebody would be upset right. that she wasn't taking good care of the child. So the involvement has to be helpful, caring. Do we value the relationships between parents and their children? I think that is so much at the core of why we have so many children unnecessarily placed in foster care, for example. Their bonds with their parents aren't valued enough. The judgments of the parents aren't valued enough. And both at the bystander level and at the state level, we need a new philosophy that is a helpful philosophy, a supportive philosophy, both at the individual level and the structural level, and that also appreciates the diversity of the way children behave. I love that about Keith's comment. This is also about appreciating children who have disabilities and welcoming them into our world, making our world more equal for them, less discriminatory. And all of this comes together, I think, in these stories that are hitting the news now.
Let me get Kate from Galloway, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Kate? No.
Sure
yes. Yeah, go ahead, Kate.
Unpopular. Yep.
No, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Now we can.
Okay, good. I want to make a comment. I'm confident it will be unpopular, but I need to say it anyway.
Go ahead.
I feel, and it's been discussed amongst friends and family members, an environment of fear today, fear about a lot of things. One of the things that that we talked about being fearful of is not taking action when we see something that is questionable. And unfortunately, in this environment of fear, it's not always an immediate intuitive act to walk up to a parent, to a person who is dealing with anything and offer help. It's more to stand back, make an assessment which may or may not be correct, and look for help from where our news programs and airports and security people are telling us to get a professional involved.
Well, Kate, yeah,
I'm sorry, but...
No, let me take your point. I'm jumping in only because we're almost out of time, and I want to give both of our guests a chance to respond. And Marie, she's talking about this sort of sense of that we live in it. I mean, in certain ways, we do live in a dangerous world, but that fear sort of permeates everything.
I agree with that, but I also feel that if we approach these situations with an openness as well as a desire to protect the child, I think my intuition is always to try to help, and I have never been in a situation, and I think they exist where, I don't know, the parent might get really mad and try to assault you, but I think openness is one good place to start.
And I'm giving you the last word for this segment. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Well,
Roberts.
I would say that we also should have systems and structures in place that support families so that parents and bystanders don't have to be so fearful. We shouldn't place this just on the bystander or on the parents, but we need to advocate together, parents at all levels, which is one maybe good possibility of now middle-class parents finding out about how much at risk they are, that advocate for more child care, better access to health care, better schools, and maybe that supportive environment at the government level will encourage us to have a more open, helping attitude that Marie was talking about.
Well, Dorothy Roberts, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times from the University of Pennsylvania. Marie Myung Okeh-Lee, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
And you can read her article in Salon, The Day I Was Nearly Arrested for Having an Autistic Son. A very short break, then we have a third guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Where you go to know, it's not just a catchphrase we throw out there because it's cute and it kind of rhymes. It's a statement of who we are and what we do at WHYY, keeping you informed all day long wherever you are, at home, in the car, at the office. WHYY is there, on the radio, live online, or via podcast. The news you trust with the variety and depth you deserve from our award-winning journalists. WHYY, anywhere you go, where you go to know.
On the next Fresh Air, George Takei of Star Trek fame has a new documentary about his life. He was 5 when his family was sent to a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II.
There were tall sentry towers with machine guns pointed at us. When I made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed me.
Takei will also talk about coming out as gay at age 68. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Inner demons. Everybody has them, and they certainly get in the way of our well-being. This is the voice that tells us we can't succeed. We're just not good enough. We may forgive others when they make mistakes, but certainly not ourselves. So, how can we deal with those negative voices that live inside of all of us? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Taming Your Inner Critic. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and joining us now is Mark Zanfrillo. He's a pediatric emergency physician, a clinical epidemiologist, and assistant professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also known as CHOP. He also heads the Child Safety Passenger Research Team at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at CHOP. And Mark Zanfrillo, nice to have you with us.
Thank you,
on
Marty.
Radio Times. I want to swing back to children in cars, especially we're in the summer, in hot cars. Why? Tell us about, first of all, how often does that happen where a child actually dies or is injured because they're left in a hot car?
Well, I think the question to how often it happens, I don't think we know the denominator, how often children are actually left in cars. But we know that from 1998 to 2013, there have been over 600 deaths from children being left in vehicles.
Wow.
Just this year, there have been over 18, and just this month, there have been 5. So it's more prevalent than we wish it was.
Well, I think we all know when you get into your car, you know, you've left it in the sun, you get into your car after, let's say, a day's of work, and it's probably well over 100 degrees. Is there something about a car that just heats up really quickly?
Yes, you have the direct sunlight through the glass, and it heats up the temperature very, very quickly. They've done many studies and show that the temperatures can drastically rise to dangerous levels over 105 degrees, 110 degrees. And the thing to keep in mind is that this, although we associate it with the summer months or warm climate areas of the U.S., it really can happen anywhere. There was a recent study that came out of Austin, Texas, that looked at the rise in temperature in vehicles, and they showed that an ambient temperature as low as 68 degrees outside could be associated with vehicular temperatures of greater than 105 degrees Fahrenheit.
Really? Really?
And in 30% of the deaths, children had been left in the vehicle for 2 hours or less. So it can very, very quickly heat up inside.
I was reading about someone that actually baked cookies on a dashboard. I mean, then a car got so hot, I'm assuming we're talking well into the 100s, that they were actually able to do that.
I saw that recently, yes, and I have to say I wasn't surprised. Families and parents may underappreciate how quickly it can heat up inside the car. I mean, certainly when we enter a car that's been left out in the hot sun, we say, wow, it's very hot, but we can immediately open the windows and cool it down. If we stay in there in that temperature, we would not be able to tolerate it for very long.
And how does a young child's body tolerate heat?
So children are different from adults. They sweat less. They have a larger body surface area to mass ratio. And their bodies heat up to 5 times faster than adults. So even, again, a mild 70-degree day can result in pediatric heat stroke.
Wow.
Most importantly, though, children are unable to free themselves from the restraint or open the doors on their own. And that's regardless of the mechanism. Whether it's a child who unintentionally enters an unlocked vehicle and then becomes trapped, or a younger child who is either left in the vehicle intentionally or unintentionally, they are literally trapped in the vehicle.
We hear, I mean, it would sort of make sense on the face of it, of parents maybe leaving a child in a car and then cracking the window, thinking, well, at least there'll be some air that'll flow through and it won't get so hot. Is that in fact true?
the cracking a window does very little to reduce the buildup of heat in the vehicle, and so that's really not a viable solution.
Are you telling us don't leave your child in a car?
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, there's new campaigns coming out now from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and from Safe Kids USA, which is an international safety organization. And what they're saying is, the NHTSA one is, where's baby, look before you lock, to literally think about every single time that you enter a vehicle and then exit a vehicle. If you have young children, look behind you. And I'm a parent of two children, 4.5 and 2.5-year-old girls, and I, you know, I have a very variable clinical schedule and travel schedule for work, and I don't take them to daycare every day. So I don't have a routine, and I'm just as vulnerable as anybody to being tired, stressed, or distracted. And so what I try to do consistently is look in the back of the vehicle every time I get out of the car. Even if I know that they haven't been there, it just becomes a habit. It takes 1 second, and it's very low tech, but can be very powerful.
But you're telling us that people can, and I'm saying here, good parents, responsible parents, can forget they left their child in a locked car?
It is unbelievable to imagine that.
It is.
But that is the case, that, you know, 50% of the child deaths are parents who unintentionally left their child in the vehicle. And you can imagine, we're a very distracted and distractible society. Yeah. You know, we're using cell phones all the time. But also, even just being a new parent or the parent of multiple kids, you're stressed, you may be tired, you're thrown off. And most of the unintentional cases, it was a change in routine. It was something where they weren't used to taking that child to daycare or school or something like that, and they just didn't remember.
Wow. I mean, talk about creatures of habit, right?
Exactly.
And how horrifying, I mean, to realize that you had left your child in a locked car.
Yes, and many of the parents whose children succumb to this have now joined the campaigns to sort of say, this can happen to anyone. Wow. It doesn't matter. You could be a very well-intended, very loving parent, but it can happen to you.
Let me reintroduce you, very quickly. That's Mark Zanfrillo, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's a pediatric emergency physician, a clinical epidemiologist, assistant professor of pediatrics at CHOP, that's the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also heads up the Child Passenger Safety Research Team at the Center for Injury Research and Prevention at CHOP. Any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I'm curious too about, let's say, children, you know, there's such a horrible conversation to have, but I want to have it anyway. Let's say a child is left in a car, a parent realizes, or they're rescued by somebody, or they get back in time. They haven't died, but they've been affected by the heat. Are there things like brain damage as a result of being left in a hot car?
Yeah, the thing that happens is when the heat builds up in the vehicle, what happens is this, you have this rapid rise and consistently high temperature in this environment, and the child can't tolerate it. And so there's an increased oxygen demand on the body, and it leaves many organs susceptible, particularly the brain. And so even if a child were to survive heat stroke from being left in a vehicle, they may have some permanent neurologic damage. Unfortunately, though, again, most of the cases happen so quickly and can happen within just a few hours of being left in the vehicle that I actually don't know of many cases of children who have survived,
You
know, who have damage. Yeah. Most of the time, it's children who are being left in the vehicle who are rescued or sort of discovered. They haven't been in for very long.
And is there treatment for that, or just sort of waiting to see the effect of all that heat on the body and on the organs?
Yeah, so if you discover a child that's been left in a hot vehicle, you know, they may be sleepy, confused, they could even be unconscious, and so I think the immediate thing to do is remove them from that heat source. You want to get them to a cool, shaded place, immediately call 911. start CPR if necessary. Right. And it's really important to get the child to a hospital, most specifically a trauma center or a pediatric trauma center. And that will ensure prompt and specialized treatment to rehydrate and cool the child to halt additional injury to the body cells, because being in that very hot condition has ongoing effects.
We were talking earlier, you work in an ER, we were talking earlier about, you know, the bystanders, the possible criminalization of parents or parenting decisions. I'd just be curious, you were listening, sort of what your thoughts were as we were talking about that.
Yeah, it's so complicated. It is very complicated, and it's challenging. And certainly working in an emergency department setting, we see a large spectrum of injury and illness, but we also see neglect and abuse. And that is certainly a spectrum, and there's a lot of gray area. At Children's Hospital Philadelphia, we do have many resources that are available to help us with these decision makings. And with much of emergency medicine, it's triaging. It's deciding, you know, if for a medical illness, how sick a patient is and whether or not they need to stay in the hospital. And in terms of neglect or abuse, what is our degree of suspicion and how safe is the child to be able to go home or not?
And if you saw a child in a car, even with the windows cracked, and it was a summer day in Philadelphia, what would you do?
Well, that's a good question. I appreciate the comments from the previous guests and callers. I think my gut would be to, first of all, I would want to look at the child and see how they're doing and sort of clinically assess them. I think trying to gather as much information as possible about where the parents could be very quickly, and if I couldn't really determine that, then I would go ahead and call 911. Mm. Better to err on that side.
Let me get, looks like Julie from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Julie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I was wondering if the auto manufacturers are doing anything to, technologically to reduce the heat buildup in the cars, because as we've already said, responsible parents can accidentally leave their child in a car.
It's a good question, and it's actually where we were taking the conversation. Go ahead, Mark.
Great. Thank you so much for that question. Yeah, the issue of technology solutions to this problem is also complicated. A few years ago, we tested some aftermarket add-on devices that could be attached to the vehicle, in particular the car seat, which would either sense the child. And the issue with some of these is that they either don't work reliably or they require the parent to be cognizant of the fact that this is a problem, purchase it, install it in the vehicle, and make sure it works. And so in that only 50% of these are unintentional leaving child in the vehicle, it doesn't address the remainder of the cases where 30% are from a child just going into a car on their own and not being able to get out, or 15% of parents actually intentionally leaving their child in the vehicle for a quick errand or something like that. But to your question about auto manufacturers, right now the auto manufacturers have not created any technology to try to either reduce the heat in the vehicle or have some intrinsic sensors. That may be something that we see in the future. We're seeing it now where there's legislation and then mandated vehicle changes to prevent rollovers. And so now there will be a mandate that all new cars in a few years from now are going to have a mandated rear view camera to prevent rollovers, unintentional rollovers of children in vehicles. So we're seeing some legislation and technology solutions that you might see in the future. But I think the bottom line is that we're not there yet. But there's no consistent or reliable method. There's no silver bullet.
Julie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Could an app or something like that get developed? But as you said, you have to be kind of proactive about this to make it effective.
That's right. And I think that, at the end of the day, in my mind, this is a supervision issue. Just like you would supervise your child, your infant or your toddler, to make sure they're safe from all the potential dangers in your house, just taking that quick look back into the back of your car every time you get out of your car is one quick and simple and effective method. I think technology right now is one tool in the toolkit, but we can't rely upon it solely.
But it's so interesting. I mean, cars now are equipped with just about every sensor, every new technology known to man and woman. And as you said, these are rare instances, but obviously just horrifying to think that a child would be left alone and possibly die in a car.
Right. And as with all of injury prevention, they're completely preventable. And so I think it's a fine balance between, for example, creating legislation or technology that's going to improve the safety of people in vehicles, you know, mandating seatbelt use, or having these mandated changes in engineering in the vehicle to maximize their safety. But it's a fine balance between leading everything up to the automakers and the government, and having your own sort of responsibility as a parent to care for your child.
And how did you get interested in this notion of, I guess, injury prevention and thinking about automobiles as well?
Yeah, at our Center for Injury Research and Prevention, it's a 17-year-old research center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and we try to focus on injuries and preventing them before they happen, to minimizing the damage once an injury has happened, to the aftercare. And I think that the technology solutions are sort of bridge the line between preventing them before they happen to as it's happening, sort of stop it and abort the event or mechanism. And so I think we need to take a multi-dimensional approach using both behavioral psychology, education, and potentially some engineering solutions.
We have an email: a chance of heat strokes in babies facing backwards in car seat in the back of the car. Does it matter, I guess, where the child is or where they're facing?
I would gather that what they're saying is that because the child's facing backwards, you may be less likely to notice them in the vehicle. And of course, we have laws and policy that recommends keeping children rear-facing up until the age of 2 years or until they outgrow the rear-facing weight or height limit of the seat. So in my response to that would be, you have to be even more particularly attentive to take that quick look after you exit the vehicle.
Just to make sure that there isn't a little body in that.
Exactly.
Well, Mark Zonfrillo, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. He's a pediatric emergency physician, a clinical epidemiologist, assistant professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he also heads up the Child Passenger Safety Research Team. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and email, Facebook, Twitter. Joyce Lieberman, Kevin Griffin, the engineers for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.